This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, some concerns that locals on remote islands in Vanuatu didn't get any warnings ahead of yesterday's tsunami waves. Also, new data shows progress is not being made on reducing carbon emissions from fossil fuels. And there's been disappointment as nature intervenes and holds up the special voyage of a traditional outrigger canoe built using traditional materials and tools.
It's more a matter of acceptance and trying to understand what it is that's happening. Why is it that the wind is not coming as it used to or as it was described to us by the older people?
We're going to have more on that story and much more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning. I'm Catherine Graham. First, though, there are reports of houses being damaged and destroyed on a remote island in Vanuatu's south after several tsunami waves hit coastal areas yesterday afternoon following a magnitude 7.5 earthquake. There are no reported casualties at this stage, but people in both Vanuatu and neighbouring New Caledonia are this morning assessing the damage, while there have been concerns raised too about the lack of warnings received in some of the more remote areas. Pacific Beat reporter Yara Murray Atfield's been following the story for us. Yara, a magnitude 7.5 quake is powerful. What more do we know?
Morning, Catherine. Well, it was just after 3 p.m. New Caledonia time when the quake struck yesterday, around 170 kilometres east of the Loyalty Islands, which is just over 300 kilometres from the territory's capital, Noumea. What made this earthquake an immediate concern was its depth. So the United States Geological Survey says it was only 10 kilometres below the surface, which is very shallow. Shortly afterwards, the Pacific Tsunami Warning Centre issued a warning saying there was a possibility of hazardous tsunami waves. So the governments in both New Caledonia and Vanuatu issued evacuation orders for some areas, and we saw people running for higher ground there. Vanuatu's Anaitcham Island is in the country's southernmost area, so it's the southernmost inhabited island of Vanuatu, closer to the epicentre of the quake. Hudson Matayo is a tourism operator based there. He told Pacific Beat the events of yesterday were quite scary for a lot of people.
It's a big experience for them. Everybody coming down past, basically to see all the debris on the beaches that we have up in dirty all over with mud. So, yeah, it's a big thing for here, for people here. We won't forget this for a long time.
Hudson Mateo speaking there on a scratchy line to Pacific Beat from Anaitcham Island in Vanuatu's south there. Yara, we're going to hear more from New Caledonia in a moment, but what do we know about the damage in Vanuatu?
Well, there are no reported casualties, but as you were just hearing there, strong waves definitely struck islands in the south. So photos we've seen show damaged houses, flooded gardens, watermarks that are metres and metres inland. Where Mr. Matayo is, it appears they've actually been sheltered somewhat by another island. But the concern is that in Vanuatu in particular, many of the places and the areas that were closest to the epicentre are small, they're remote, and some are hard to access at the best of times. So the full scale of the damage may take some days to be fully realised. Another Anaitcham resident is Joseph Yasifu, who's a tour operator there, but he's on a different part of the island where it appears they may have been more exposed to the tsunami's waves. Pacific Beat spoke to him this morning. It was in Bislama. Let's have a listen.
Move out or one want to start our house no more. All man only said the first way for me and we come inside and all man only just stop move out law village. I get all not been receiving any information. So get an only custom full of permits law village small get up.
Joseph Yasifu there speaking in Bislama. He was explaining that people really didn't get any warnings. They stayed put when they felt the earthquake. And it was only when they had that first wave that they then realised they needed to get out. So it's certainly experienced some damage in that area.
Yeah, that's right, Catherine. He also says there were four waves in total. He believes the water went as far as 2 kilometres inland from the shore in some parts, and that up to 6 teachers' houses had been destroyed in one village, as well as damaging the local school and many gardens. And assessment and relief efforts may be hampered by the fact that the wet season has just begun in the Pacific. It's now raining quite heavily across many places in Vanuatu's south.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you. That's Yara Murray Atfield there. And we will continue to reach out to particularly disaster authorities in Vanuatu to get more information. Well, we're over in New Caledonia. Cameron Diver is the Deputy Director General of the Pacific Community, SPC. I spoke with him on the line from the capital, Noumea, a short time ago. Cameron Diver, thanks for speaking with Pacific Beach. You were based or are based in Noumea. I understand your office evacuated yesterday as a precautionary measure. Were there plenty of warnings in time there, at least in the capital?
Yes, we were warned at least 50 to 55 minutes before the prediction said the first waves could hit. So that gave us ample time to let our staff know that it was time to head home and or to higher ground as a precaution. There were messages that went out from local authorities also on social media and the radio, and the police force obviously came down to coastal areas in town to warn people verbally about the situation if they didn't have a radio or another means of communication. We also know that in the Loyalty Islands, which were the most exposed to the potential hazards of the tsunami alert sirens did go off, and people once again were instructed to move up from coastal areas to the higher plateaus. And again, there was door-to-door verification that people had actually received the warning so that they could get out of the danger zone as quickly as possible.
So certainly with plenty of warning, it does seem that obviously there shouldn't be any reported loss of life. What do we know, though, about the extent of any damage?
What I know this morning is that apparently there was a 2-metre wave that came through to the Isle of Pines, which is south of Noumea. There was a difference about 90 centimetres that was detected by the tide gauge in Tadin, which is the closest village to the epicentre of the earthquake. So there's expected to be some minor damage from that, and I expect we'll get more details as the day goes on. But right now, what I would expect from this sort of event is some quite significant coastal erosion. And obviously, if that erosion affects any infrastructure that is near the coast, there is likely to be some form of damage in that form. As of this morning, I haven't heard any reports of injury or loss of life. But once again, that's something that we'll need to wait to hear on from authorities later in the day, I expect.
And how remote are some of these communities? And do you think it is going to take some time, one, to get reports back from them about the extent of damage? And as you said, obviously, even if they are remote, they at least were able to, were set up well enough to get sirens and get the warnings.
Communities here are remote because they're on islands. I suppose one of the advantages that there are fairly decent communication systems that are in place that will allow people to phone in and out. And the New Caledonian and French authorities have outposts in the Loyalty Islands and on the Isle of Pines, which means that there's a degree of proximity that you don't need to deploy necessarily from the mainland to get that information. I would expect that we'd be getting information reasonably swiftly, and there wouldn't be delays as you might expect in other parts of the Pacific, which are extremely isolated and aren't necessarily connected to some of the modern communication networks that allow us to get that information swiftly.
Indeed, and we are starting to have some of that information filter through from other parts of the Pacific, and in Vanuatu, for example, where we understand there were also waves, and we're seeing photos as well now. And some of the messages that we're seeing is people saying that this was a good reminder, a good lesson at this particular time. I mean, tsunamis can obviously happen at any time. We're heading into cyclone season as well. Do you think people in the Pacific are well equipped to handle these things, or are reminders helpful in these sorts of situations?
I think reminders are always helpful in these sorts of situations. It's one thing to talk about these events and to know either intellectually or in an abstract way that they can happen. We've observed it in other parts of the world this year. But when it actually happens in your neighbourhood, it's an extremely good reminder of what it is that you need to do to stay safe, and the measures that authorities might need to look at to ensure that they're able to warn their populations and take care of them as quickly as possible.
Cameron Diver from the Pacific community in New Caledonia. Well, new data is being released today. The climate change talks underway in Poland, and it shows that progress is not being made on reducing carbon emissions from fossil fuels. George Roberts has the story.
Cars pumping petrol, trucks burning diesel, and coal firing power stations. They're some of the culprits named for global CO2 emissions going in the wrong direction. Dr. Pep Canadel is from the Global Carbon Project at the CSIRO.
Emissions have to go down immediately. There's no longer, you know, saying over the next 3 years they need to come down, because the emission rates that are required anywhere between 3 to 5% are becoming unachievable.
New data to be released today by the CSIRO shows that global fossil fuel emissions are on track to reach a record high this year. Even with renewable energy take-up doubling every 4 years, it's not enough to neutralise the growth in carbon emissions. Professor Frank Yotso from the Centre for Climate Economics and Policy at the Australian National University says Australia's not on target to meet the emissions cuts it committed to under the Paris Agreement.
That would require reductions of around about 10 million tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalent per year, or about 2% of existing emissions every year without exception between now and 2030. So that is actually a very significant task.
The former president of the Australian Conservation Foundation and Griffith University Emeritus Professor is Ian Lowe. He's seen the numbers.
They're very concerning. I mean, it's clear that we're not making the progress that was envisaged in the Paris Agreement in 2015. So it's clear that nations around the world aren't doing enough to slow down climate change.
The Australian government, though, recently has said that it will meet its Paris targets. Are you saying that Australia isn't on track either?
Australia certainly isn't on track. What the government has said is that they're on target to reduce emissions from the electricity sector by 26 to 28%. But the Paris Agreement was that we would reduce our overall emissions by 26 to 28%. To meet the Paris target, we'd need to be reducing emissions from electricity by something like 60 or 70%.
Given that Australia is only 1 to 2% of global emissions, is it really going to make a difference?
That's a reasonable point, except that every country except the US and China could say exactly the same. It's all of the 1 and 2% from all of the little countries that add up to the other 60% outside the US and China.
What sort of picture of the future are we looking at if we keep on this course?
The World Meteorological Organization released a report earlier this week which said that we're currently on target for 3 or 4 degrees increase in global average temperature by the end of this century. And if the world as a whole is 3 or 4 degrees warmer, then it'll be 10 or 12 degrees warmer in inland Australia. And what that would mean is whole areas of Australia will simply be uninhabitable.
It's Emeritus Professor Ian Lowe speaking there with reporter George Roberts.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, Indonesia's president has ordered the police and military to catch all of those involved in the recent killing of more than 30 construction workers in Papua province earlier this week. It's been described as possibly the worst violence in decades in what's an ongoing conflict between pro-independence West Papua supporters and the Indonesian government. Armed men, believed to be part of a separatist group linked to the Free Papua movement, stormed a government-owned road-building project and killed dozens of Indonesian workers. Benny Wender is the chairman of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua. While he doesn't condone the violence, he told me that the armed men, who he describes as the West Papuan military, are there to defend their sovereignty. We spoke a short time ago.
West Papua military, military people who believe that just like those Indonesian military, protecting the land and, the lands and the nations, and also Indonesian military are the police and, are there. And I always call, West Papua military always a home guard, and they defend themselves, defend their land, defend their, forests and mountains. And, they defend our political right and our sovereignty right. And for decades, nearly 5 decades. So, yeah, that's my view on what's going on in
West. Yeah, so in this case where more than 30 people were killed, is that something that you actually support when you say that the West Papuan military are there to protect their land, et cetera?
No, I'm not saying that. But what's happening now related to the 1st of December is hundreds of thousands of the West Papuan came out, including West Papua Indonesian citizens across the archipelago, and some of them Indonesian military beating their own people. And this is Indonesian military and police and government are worried, the concern. And then this is same time this is happening, because we know that for sure Indonesia knows that as ordinary people coming out on the street, and that's great danger and their sovereignty. That's what they are seeing. So that's why this is why now happen, and that is my view. This is what happening, and I'm sure that in West Papua military wing there is different source coming out, but I as the political leader, and I'm a leader whole West Papua, which is inside and West Papua and outside, I'm speaking the since that we form United Liberation Movement as the political organization to bring all those faction groups. Now, I'm saying that we already declared a peacefully mean to solve this West Papua issue with Indonesia government, hold a referendum for West Papua, and people give the West Papuan people choose whether they want to stay with Indonesia or they want to free. That the UNWP are campaigning for the internationally and diplomatically to engage the United Nations, for example, and Human Rights Council, for example. And we also calling for Indonesia allow UN fact-finding visiting in West Papua. And that is the 1st of December I'm announcing. But at the same time, this is happening.
Well, you say, yes, you want to resolve this peacefully, but surely this latest incident where people were killed goes against that. Do you think that these killings will harm you and your group and what you believe in and what you're standing for?
That's correct.
That's Benny Wendes, chairman of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua. Well, here in Australia, momentum appears to be building in Parliament to pass legislation today that would allow faster medical treatment for asylum seekers and refugees on Manus Island in PNG and also Nauru. The opposition Labor Party, the Greens and several crossbenchers have teamed up to introduce amendments to a government bill which would allow refugees to be transferred to Australia on the advice of doctors. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, though, has slammed that push. He's told Sydney's 2GB radio station it would give the green light to people smugglers.
They don't believe in having stronger borders. This is an absolutely destructive and irresponsible and reckless move by the Labor Party.
That is the Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison there. Well, up until now, the transfers of refugees and asylum seekers to Australia on medical grounds has been a secretive process. The ABC's 7:30 program has revealed confidential details of the powerful government committee that approves them. And as Paul Farrell reports, the body discussed eradicating a long-standing requirement that medical care in offshore facilities must meet Australian standards.
Who has the final say about whether or not people are actually transferred to Australia or anywhere else for medical purposes?
Senator, good morning. Kingsley Woodford-Smith, Assistant Commissioner, Detention and Offshore Operations Command.
Kingsley Woodford-Smith is part of the government's Transitory Persons Committee, the group of top-level bureaucrats who decide where refugees will receive urgent medical treatment.
So you make the recommendation?
No, I make the final decision.
Now 7:30 can reveal the confidential deliberations of this little-known body. These secret minutes detail the inner workings of Australia's medical transfer of refugees from Nauru over the past 18 months. In one case, doctors from International Health and Medical Services advised that a refugee with moderately urgent needs be transferred to Australia for treatment unavailable locally. But the committee overruled the advice, agreeing to revisit the matter only when the patient's condition worsened.
You should see in there the detail of the efforts that they go to make certain that the people do not get to Australia.
Barrister Geoffrey Watson has acted for many refugees on Nauru and has serious reservations about the committee.
Well, I'm stunned at the composition of the committee. It's primarily bureaucrats, it's heavily laden with lawyers, and every now and then there might be a medico, a doctor present.
Some refugees have been sent to Australia on the advice of treating doctors. But last year, Australia signed an agreement with Taiwan, meaning asylum seekers could be sent there for medical treatment instead of Australia.
There's a couple of instances where I've read that they wanted to send them instead to Port Moresby. Fair enough, that's not too far. But many instances where they try to send them to Taiwan instead of Australia.
In October 2017, the departmental body assured a Senate committee that it based its decisions on medical advice.
Oh, sorry, the decision. Yep. Okay. And you make it on the basis of medical advice?
That's correct, Senator.
Only on medical advice?
That's correct, Senator.
Have you refused any?
Senator, there would be cases that I have refused at different times.
Minutes from that same month reveal the committee discussed removing a long-standing requirement that the medical care guaranteed to refugees should meet Australian standards.
They want to remove the reference to Australian standards so that they can lower the standard of care provided to these people.
On Monday, independent MP Karen Phelps introduced a bill to Parliament to reform the medical transfer system and remove children from Nauru immediately.
I made it a priority when I came to Canberra that I would do whatever I could to make sure that every child and their family was removed from Nauru to come to Australia for medical and psychiatric evaluation and treatment. What we need to see is the decision about urgent medical transfers handed back to the doctors who are treating the patient. The current process for medical transfers is absolutely unacceptable. I believe that the medical decisions should be made primarily by medical practitioners. There's clearly a role for ministerial oversight, but I believe that that role should be well defined.
Geoffrey Watson is just one of many human rights lawyers to bring civil proceedings against the Australian government on behalf of refugees who require urgent medical care. With legal action intensifying last year, Immigration Department lawyers began attending committee meetings. The lawyers and the committee expressed concern over the close scrutiny of one case in particular.
It's been established that the Commonwealth has been acting in breach in urgent cases. Of course, they want to keep it away from the scrutiny of an impartial judge.
In a statement, the Department of Home Affairs told 730 that it did take into account the advice of treating doctors when considering medical transfers.
It's Paul Farrell reporting this from the ABC's 730 program. Well, finally this morning here on Pacific Beat, you may remember that we've previously brought you the story of a special canoe voyage aimed at reconnecting the Polynesian communities in Solomon Islands with families in Vanuatu. But the outrigger canoe that they'd built using traditional materials and tools and is known as the Te Puka only made it halfway before nature intervened. But as Evan Wasuka reports, the crew's not giving up on their dream.
For 2 days, they sailed their Te Puka in open seas.
This falavaka actually had me safe.
This vaka is safe. Traditionally, I feel our ancestral spirits are part of the vessel. I believe our traditional things, like this vaka, it's not just ourselves, but ancestral spirits are with us.
Stanley Tehiahua is a crew member.
After 3 days, we decided to call in at Vanikoro to wait out for this wind, but it didn't happen. The wind was very low. It would shift into the direction, but it was only at 4 to 5 knots.
After 2 weeks of waiting and food supplies close to finish, the team decided it was time to return to base at Lata.
I think it was a feeling of, well, there was some frustration, but it's more a matter of acceptance and trying to understand what it is that's happening. Why is it that the wind is not coming as it used to, or as it was described to us by the older people?
Anthropologist Mimi George is part of the crew. She is one of the founders of the Vakatau Mako project and had been working towards this voyage for the past 25 years.
To see this actually happening was very inspiring and, you know, motivating to try to get people, governments and funding organizations to understand the importance of people actually learning how to do this sort of thing and how to work together.
Mr. Tehiahua is adamant that the journey is far from over. He says the crew are still camping out in Lata and waiting for favorable wind conditions before returning to their Te Puka.
Actually, every crew sort of agree.
Every crew agree and still have that strong mind to make the trip to Sola if wind comes around either in December or the following month.
Manoa Tepa is the acting chief forecaster at the meteorological office. He says the current El Nino is dampening the likelihood of strong trade winds.
Winds will be weaker because of weaker high pressure systems. So we have trade winds weaker in areas, and winds may reverse to northeast or northwesterly to westerly winds.
But the wind alone is not the only challenge the Vakatau Mako is facing. Ms. George says the delay in the schedule has also affected finances.
There is no escort boat anymore, so they need to have the funds for airline tickets, etc., to come back from Vanuatu. And then next year, they're going to have to go back to Vanuatu to get on the canoe and get it ready and then sail it back to Solomon's.
While the Vakatau Mako didn't make it as far as Sola, they did reconnect with the people of Vanikoro and plan to return to the island to pick up where they had left off. Just when that will be is not yet clear.
That's Evan Wasuka reporting there from the Solomon Islands capital, Honiara. And that is all for Pacific Beach this morning. We're on in the afternoons as well, though. That's from 3 p.m. PNG time. That'll be 6 o'clock if you're in Fiji. That's all for today. I'm Catherine Grout. Join me at the same time tomorrow.